What if everything you know about the concept of economic cost is wrong? Now, you could be somebody who studied economics at university. You could even be an economics professor. You could run your own business. You could be an accountant. And still, you probably have been taught about cost in the wrong way. And today, I'm going to get into exactly what I mean. Now, the key people who have thought deeply about this historically were the Nobel Prize-winning economist James M. Buchanan, the London School of Economics lecturer, basically, at the turn of the 20th century, Philip Wicksteed. He was kind of late Victorian, early 20th century figure, and also the Austrian school in general, but particularly its founder, Karl Menger. What is it that people tend to get wrong about cost? Well, we're going to get into it over the course of this. Now, this could take an hour, but trust me, once you see this, you won't unsee it. And this is one of the reasons that I've never abandoned Austrian economics, because it provides insights into areas that other people just take for granted willy-nilly. I'm going to go into the foundations of exactly where this disagreement on cost started. I'm going to go through some of these key thinkers: Menger, Wicksteed, James M. Buchanan. I'm going to talk a little bit about price formation and exchange. I'm going to deal with some of the major objections that, for example, post-Keynesians like Steve Keen have raised. And I think they're actually fairly trivial to deal with. And then I'm going to talk about the implications for policy, planning, business, and just your own life and the way you think about cost in general. So let's get going here. The common myth is that production costs have a direct impact on prices, that if a producer has something in his own costs go up, that's therefore going to be reflected in the consumer price at the end of the chain. And therefore, because of that, it is the production costs that are dictating the price. Now, on an intuitive level, right, this kind of makes sense. You think, well, you know, the shop that you're buying the good from bought a good at a wholesale price. He needs to make a profit. So therefore, he has his markup. So the cost, if his costs go up, he still needs to make a profit. Therefore, his markup is going to be on top. Therefore, the consumer price will go up. However, this is actually fundamentally mistaken, and it misunderstands cause and effect in quite a major way. Even though it's intuitive, even though in everyday life, you know, it seems like common sense, actually, when you drill down into it, it is not really how cost works. What I'm going to be talking about in this video is basically that all cost is sunk cost, all cost is opportunity cost, and ultimately, all cost is just in your head. It's just a psychological phenomenon, which is wild when you start thinking about it, but let me explain. So most schools get this wrong. The classical economists, that's your Adam Smith and Ricardo and contemporaries, they saw cost as being real and measurable, and it was downstream of the labor theory of value. They, you know, when this pencil was made, according to, you know, Adam Smith and friends, the person who made it or the factory that made it imbued this pencil, this pen, with some sort of medical value from their labor. They imbued it almost like wizards, imbued this pen with value. Okay, and that's why it has any worth. Okay, so that is the classical, that's where they went wrong, because they saw the cost embedded in the product. The Marxists, they somewhat followed Ricardo, but Marx updated it and talked about socially necessary labor time. That is, in the layman, the smallest amount of money that you can pay a man before he starves to death, or him and his family starve to death. I guess you'd call it subsistence wages. People talked about subsistence farming. Well, this is where Marx is taking the concept from. What is the smallest amount a man can have before he keels over and dies through starvation. And whatever that is the socially necessary labor time. Okay, so then we can move on to the Keynesians and the post-Keynesians. They see it as a pure, you know, the production costs and then the markup price. They called it administered prices set by firms via cost plus demand manages output, not price. Okay, and a lot of what the Keynesians say is if you look at how firms actually work, they have a certain degree of slack. A lot of them do production on demand. Okay, they're able to produce a lot more than the total demand in the market. So they adjust their production, you know, just in time. And they do various other things. But essentially, it is whatever your production costs plus the markup. Okay, that's the Keynesian view. And then in the neoclassical view, this is Milton Friedman, the Chicago School, you know, generally people on the free market and even people like the IEA in London would think about it in this way, despite the fact that James M. Buchanan is on the wall there. You can bet your bottom dollar, most economists there do not take what Buchanan said seriously on cost. The neoclassicals, they say supply curves encode objective production costs. Equilibrium price equates marginal cost to demand. So there it's basically, yeah, it's supply and demand that's setting the price, but ultimately cost is built in. So the neoclassicals basically have this big black box that says cost on it. And it's like, well, somehow that's involved. When we get to Marshall's scissors, I'll delve further into the neoclassical way of thinking about cost. But suffice to say, I'm going to be explaining exactly why this is wrong in this video. So the key thinkers that we're looking at today are Karl Menger, who was the founder of the Austrian School. He was around at the end of the 19th century and at the start of the 20th century. Then we're also going to be looking at basically a contemporary of Menger's, who was based in London. He gave lectures at the London School of Economics, Philip Wicksteed, who also thought rather deeply about these things. He had the advantage, in my view, of being an outsider to the economics profession. He was something of, you know, the gentleman amateur coming in. Often it's those sorts of figures that can see something that the entrenched establishment cannot. I'm always drawn towards slightly unorthodox people like Wicksteed, who are coming in from the outside. They can see something because they haven't been brainwashed, okay? And then the final person we're going to be considering is James M. Buchanan, who wrote a classic book in 1969 called Cost and Choice that went through some of these things that I'm going to be talking about. So the key idea from Karl Menger is that value is subjective. Now, I'm going to pull myself up here because we all understand this at a certain level, okay? Value is subjective. And when we are making consumer choices in the everyday world, we make these kind of subjective value judgments all the time. And the reason I pull myself up is because recently I've been forced to think about my own consumer choices. This jar of coffee here, this is a espresso rich cream of coffee. I actually prefer the Marks and Spencer's one, but I couldn't find that in this where I bought this, so I had to buy this. If you've noticed recently, coffee's gone really quite expensive in this country. I think I paid something like £7 for this. That's towards the upper end of what I'm willing to pay. Now, let's pretend that this coffee went up to £10 a jar. I'm then forced to be like, well, how much do I really value drinking? Is it worth £10 to me? You're starting to really ask a question, okay? Well, let's say it was £15. To quote Duncan Bannatyne, I'm out. I am not. Once this hits £15, you can forget about it, Nescafe. I'll shift over to another good. I'll shift over to tea. I particularly like this Yorkshire tea malty biscuit brew. Okay, and I'm like, well, I'll just have to drink tea until the price of this coffee comes down. I'm just not willing to pay 15 quid for this. Okay. 7 quid is a bit rich. Okay. And everybody has something like that value scale in their own head. Everybody at some point is going to be unwilling to pay more. It's not, I like coffee, but do I like it £15 a jar? I'm going to leave it. Okay. So you can see on a kind of personal level that everybody does have these subjective value calculations, okay, in their own minds. However, people forget about the fact, and this is the important point, really. People forget about the fact that the producer, and okay, the producer could be a massive firm, okay, or the producer could be a farmer, or the producer could be, you know, somebody who owns a factory. They are also making their own subjective valuations. And their subjective valuations are actually downstream from the consumer valuation. Okay, now, one of my favorite examples to explain this is actually the coffee plantation. Okay, this is called Menger's theory of imputation. But here's me, the consumer, at the end of the line, buying my coffee for £7. If you're wondering, by the way, why coffee is £7, I did briefly look into this. And, you know, this is a F.A. Hayek's point about knowledge and the price signal. Well, the price signal, coffee's gone up. What has caused that? Did the production costs of coffee go up for the producers? No, not really. What happened is that there's been severe shortages of coffee in Brazil owing to environmental factors. And because Brazil is the number one coffee producer and it's having shortages, that has pushed the price of coffee up in the worldwide coffee market. That's why I'm paying £7. When that shortage is over, presumably that price will come down again. Okay. It seems high, right? So it may come down again. Anyway, point is to get back to the coffee plantation. Why does anybody open a coffee plantation in the first place? Why would the land on which you could grow coffee start to be valued highly? Is it intrinsically valuable in and of itself? Or do people just start coffee farms for the love of running farms and growing coffee beans? No, they don't. They do all of these things because Muggins by here buys coffee at the end of the chain. Right. If there weren't people like me spending the £7 for the coffee at the end of the chain, all of those coffee plantations in Brazil and all of the farmers who got into the coffee trade and Nescafe and so on, well, they'd go out of business or they get into some other business because this business would be no longer profitable. Coffee would just be kind of a useless, smelly bean. Right. Because if so, what I'm saying is, it derives its entire value from the fact that people want it. And this, I mean, we talk about common sense. This is absolute common sense. There is no way in which this is not true. And yet, because it's so simple, economists and people who think about cost and people who think about how value works forget about that fact at some point in their thinking. So we have to remind ourselves always that the only reason that a coffee bean has any value is because people drink coffee. The only reason that a coffee plantation has any value is because people want coffee beans to make coffee. The only reason that land has value is because people need the coffee. And the only reason any of those things happen is because Muggins by here buys the coffee. Okay? You understand this. You also can see it throughout history as different precious metals have had different relative prices over time. Once upon a time, tin was worth more than gold because tin was more scarce and it was extremely malleable and easy to work with. So at one point in history, tin was more valuable than gold. We think of gold as being like the metal, right? The most expensive one. Not always been the case. The point of it is that there's no actual intrinsic reason why gold is more valuable than tin or vice versa. It is simply the use value relative to human needs at that moment in time and the subjective evaluations therein. Just like if you could imagine a world where people stop drinking coffee, the coffee bean becomes worthless. So the conditions that made tin more expensive than gold no longer persisted. Therefore, tin dropped relative to gold. And also the uses of gold went up over time as well.
Ultra Bundle! Seven courses. Shakespeare! Research! The Trivium! Economics! Politics! The Ultra Bundle! Buy it now!
So, anyway, that is Karl Menger. Let us now talk about opportunity costs. Everybody has some notion of an opportunity cost. You have paid an opportunity cost to watch this video. You have, so far, you've listened to me talk for 15 minutes. You could have been doing something else. You could have been, I don't know, out walking your dog or out gardening or watching somebody else or just doing anything else or doing 15 minutes of work or reading a book, right? You have paid 15 minutes of time to watch me, and that is an opportunity cost. The option you sacrifice when you choose. It's always forward-looking. It's always personal. It's always unique to the person at the time, because your 15 minutes is not the same as every other person's. Okay, thousands of people will watch this video, and each one of them will have a different subjective valuation on how they have chosen to spend their time. That is called opportunity cost. No external observer can really measure the opportunity cost either. So that 15 minutes you've spent, sorry to say, is foregone. That means you can never get it back. That means no, like, you're not owed it. I don't owe it to you. You've lost it forever. Okay? You've made your choice. This is the cost, and you've made a choice, and therefore you've paid the cost. What is the cost you paid? All of those are the things that you could be doing. But so it is with spending 15 minutes watching a YouTube video. So it is with every decision you make, but not only you, every decision that every business makes, every decision that every operator or agent in the marketplace makes is also governed in exactly the same way. That means that all costs you make are opportunity costs. And at the same time as they're all opportunity costs, they are all what you call sunk costs. That is, you're not getting that, you know, okay, now it's 17 minutes. You're not getting the 17 minutes back. Okay. Now that's 17. Now it may not be 17 minutes. It could be 17 pounds. Okay. And to come back, I'm not getting the £7 I paid for this coffee back. Okay. Now, I could be getting cups of enjoyment. I could try to, like, tell myself each time I drink this coffee, I'm getting my £7 worth. Okay. But the fact of the matter is that the £7 has left my bank account. It is gone. I have this. Okay. But I don't have £7 anymore. Right. All of the other things, the way I justify it to myself, are in the head. Okay. I could be like, well, I actually hate this coffee. It wasn't worth £7. Doesn't matter. I'm actually loving it. It's worth way more than £7. It doesn't matter. Okay. It really doesn't matter, because the point is the cost is foregone. It is gone forever. So you can understand this on this rather kind of, you know, personal level. But what people then fail to do is they fail to scale it up to the enterprise level, to the business level. Yet these principles are all exactly the same. I want to just dwell so you absolutely understand what opportunity cost is. Right. I'll get myself out of the way here. So the £50 dinner, right? You go out for dinner, you spend £50. You go to a restaurant. What do you do? What are you foregoing? Well, there's the £50 that you could have spent on anything else. You're foregoing reading a book. You're foregoing putting £50 into your saving contributions. You're foregoing an evening at the theatre. You're foregoing watching the World Cup, right? Whatever it is that is going on right now, you're choosing to do the £50 dinner over all of those other things. And the cost for that, okay, foregone, it is already foregone. It is sunk, right? And so there's a certain way of thinking, well, you know, you've forgone all the thing, you made your choice, you might as well enjoy the dinner, okay? But however you process it, whether you sit there thinking, I'm actually glad I forwent all those other things. I'm really enjoying the company. I'm enjoying this glass of wine. I'm having a great steak. I'm having a great time. Okay, this is the best choice. Or whether you sit there stewing, being like, oh, actually, I really wanted to watch the football, or I wish I was reading that book, or I really wish, you know, this is a rubbish meal. It doesn't matter. You see, it doesn't matter how you process it in your mind. The choice is made. Okay, and this is really important to stress. Or you can have a look at a factory floor. Right, these are some examples that Philip Wicksteed, who talked a lot about opportunity cost, talked about. He said, on the factory floor, a manufacturer is occupying a factory to produce widgets, and it incurs an opportunity cost equal to the value of the next best use of producing gadgets, leasing the floor to a rival, converting the space to be a warehouse, to be storage. The accountant's depreciation schedule captures absolutely none of the fact that as long as the factory floor is being used to make widget, it's not being used to do any of those other things. These are hidden opportunity costs that any factory could also be doing. But the accountant can't, he can only see dollars and cents. He doesn't capture any of that data whatsoever. So the accountant can't actually see the real, it's actually the reverse of what people say. Oh, you know, you can see the price of everything, but the value of nothing. Actually, the accountant doesn't even see the true price because he cannot see all of these opportunity costs that have been paid. So this is really Philip Wicksteed's number one insight, which is cost is always foregone. The cost of anything is simply the alternative that has to be foregone in order to get it. The radical implication of Wicksteed is that sunk and historical costs are irrelevant to the current price. What was paid yesterday cannot be recovered. It cannot rationally influence today's decision. Only prospective, still open alternatives matter. Okay, and again, if we come back to my coffee here, let's just pretend I was like, all right, I've had enough of this coffee. I want to try to like flog it on. I'm going to try to set it on for £8. Okay. The fact I paid £7 for it is neither here nor there. I'm going to have to try to convince somebody else to buy it for £8 now. Okay, maybe I won't be able to. Let's say I start putting propaganda around to try to influence, like, this is the elixir of life. You drink this and it'll like give you magical powers. You drink this and it'll make you live longer. You drink this and it'll make you sexy. You know, I'm trying to artificially drive up the price of it. But the fact is, the person at the end of the line, he doesn't really care how much I paid for it in the first place. All he's thinking about is this worth £8 to me? Okay, and it could be, I mean, who knows what conditions go into every single person's subjective valuations. The point is, the fact that I paid £7 for it is neither here nor there and will never be here nor there. The only person that's important to is me. And you can think about it in this way. Think of a gambler who's gone to the casino and he's doing his little gambling system. And he's like, well, he's ended up losing five grand on the cards, or he's playing blackjack and he's lost £5,000. And he's thinking to himself, I need to win this £5,000 back. me to keep gambling until I got my $5,000 back. Okay. Now, I'm pretty sure that's called something like the gambler's fallacy. That, you know, are you really trying to, like, that $5,000 is lost? You could lose more money trying to win the $5,000 back, but it's just in your head. The fact that you think that $5,000 is, you've already lost it. It's just in your head. So this £7 I've paid is already gone. Okay, I know I'm laboring this point, but it's really important to understand what I'm about to talk about, that you understand that the £7 I paid for this is neither here nor there. I can try to, like the gambler in the casino, try to claw that money back. The fact is, it's gone. And the only reason I feel the loss is psychological. It's a psychological thing. Okay, let's carry on. Wicksteed established that sunk expenditure, money already spent on machinery, research, or inventory, have zero influence on the price at which the good should be rationally offered today. Price is set by the value of what could still be done with a resource. The moment an alternative closes, its cost ceases to exist economically. Only forward-looking, open decisions carry genuine cost. Okay, and again, you know, I know it's a slightly different because he's talking about producers, but the fact is, even if I try to sell this now, the money I spent on it is how can I put this? It's like, it is not a factor in what it's going to go for. Now, one of the ways of thinking about producers investing in capital equipment, investing in their stock, investing in their inventory, okay, is that obviously they're buying these things with the hope to flog them if they're a merchant. So what they're doing in effect is a forward projection of a sale that they hope to make. And they hope to make that sale at a higher value than the one that they bought, that the one that they bought it for. But it's still, at the end of the day, just a bet. That price that they at the end of the line is not set in stone. And how do we know that it's not set in stone? Because the fact of the matter is, in the real marketplace, stuff gets decreased in price all the time. When people put on sales, when, you know, everything must go, they have to clear the stock, things are about to go off. You know, everybody's seen those kind of fire sales that take place. And that proves that it is not cost setting price, it is not the firm setting the price, it is ultimately what people are willing to pay setting the price at the end of the line. This now gets us on to James Buchanan, whose classic book, Cost and Choice, sharpened the insight further. He says, choice only influences decisions not yet made. Okay, not yet made, i.e. those choices that have already been made have always already foregone. And yet people always forget about this fact. The cost of making a choice is borne solely by the chooser. No outsider actually experiences your loss. Okay. Third, it is therefore completely unmeasurable externally. It cannot be observed, it cannot be quantified, it cannot be transferred. And it is obliterated, that is completely destroyed, at the moment of choice. Once decided, the foregone alternative is gone. It is final. You have made your decision. Have you made your decision for Christ? Right? You can't get it back. £7 is gone. Now, I can try to make another £7, but I'm not making that £7 back. That's another £7. So some of Buchanan's examples, we've already touched on these, really, is that reading his book, reading his the choice to read his preface, just like watching this video, costs you whatever you valued most doing instead. And the cost is real to you, but that cost is invisible to everybody else. Or when a baker chooses to put his shop between Elm Street and Oak Street, he incurs the opportunity cost equal to the expected profit on Oak Street, a figure that exists only in the baker's forward-looking imagination, not on any balance sheet. I hope you starting to understand what is being discussed here. Now, back in your economics classes, you may have been taught something like Marshall's scissors. In the standard frame, Alfred Marshall, who was another economist, famously compared price determination to a pair of scissors, where demand, okay, subjective utility, was on one blade and supply and cost was on the other blade. Okay, and neither blade alone cuts. The analogy is useful, but it conceals a very subtle error, which is that one of these blades has got kind of a magical non-measurable thing built into it, namely cost. Marshall treated the cost of the blade as largely objective, grounded in real resource outlays. The Austrian tradition challenges this directly. Now, this is why I'm going to keep on coming back to this coffee. According to Alfred Marshall, the value of this coffee, if I try to flog it to somebody else, has the £7, right? On one of the blades, it's got the £7 as well as the world supply of coffee built into it. But is that right? You know it's not. You know that it's not right. You know that what I paid for it is neither here nor there. Okay? And obviously we're going to have to forget about the fact that I've opened it already and I've already had a couple of, pretend it's full for the purposes of this. Okay, let's carry on. Both of the blades of Marshall scissors are actually subjective. There is no objective cost bit of it, and yet Marshall has forgotten about this and smuggled it back in, around the back door. And then the neoclassical economists and the Chicago School, Milton Friedman and so on, also just forget about this fact, and therefore cost is back, snuck in under the hood. The demand blade is aggregate consumer subjective utility rankings, well accepted as psychological. I'm not willing to pay more than about a tenner for that coffee there. If it was £15, I'd switch to tea permanently. Too rich. Everybody understands this from a consumer point of view. But the producer and the factory owner also have subjective rankings of foregone alternatives. Just with the baker or various other examples, the factory owner. And they are equally psychological, but the psychological element is routinely ignored, probably because of accountants, which I'll get onto in a moment. Price emerges from the interaction of two sets of subjective valuations, nothing more, nothing less. It is pure supply and pure demand. There is no cost element, okay? Factoring into the actual price. Prices actually emerge from exchange. Prices are not pushed by costs. When a producer's costs go up and they therefore put their own prices up, what they're doing is chancing their arm. They're saying, let's see if the consumers will bear these prices, these costs for us. Let's see if Muggins will actually pay £7 for the coffee or not. How much does he really care about his coffee? Let's ask him the question. But don't forget that the producers are only asking the question of the consumer, not saying you have to pay this price, because the consumer can always say, forget about it. We're not paying that. I'll buy something else. I'll just stop buying your thing. They are outcomes of voluntary exchange between parties, each acting on their own subjective rankings of alternatives. Producers enter markets with expected price estimates in mind. Those expectations guide what they produce, how much and at what terms, The market process then validates or corrects those expectations through profit and loss. So let's have a look at a real world supply chain. Try to get myself out of the way. And I thought it might be helpful to think about Sainsbury's purchasing cans of Coca-Cola, because everybody understands, if you're American, Sainsbury's is just a giant supermarket like Walmart or something like this, okay? Consumers buy Coca-Cola. Sainsbury's purchase cans of Coca-Cola with a wholesale payment. That is, they say to Coca-Cola, look, we think we're going to sell this many cans of Coca-Cola, and we'll give you this amount of money. You can take your money, and we will make our money on the margin in between what they pay Coca-Cola and what the customer pays. Okay. Now, because Coca-Cola make their money no matter what, right? Coca-Cola are laughing. They're like, well, we've made our wholesale money from Sainsbury's, and it doesn't really matter if Sainsbury's sell those cans or not, because we've made our money already. That's basically how wholesale works. And Sainsbury's, meanwhile, have to worry about the cans of Coke selling. What if the cans of Coke are priced wrongly and they're just sitting on the shelves at the end of the month, where they can't shift them anymore? Okay. But Coca-Cola is not actually immune to this effect, because if people simply stop buying Coca-Cola, Sainsbury's on the next procurement round would simply tell Coca-Cola, look, we either want to buy less Coke, one, or we think that Coke is priced wrongly now, and we're just not going to pay. We're going to have to reduce the amount we pay you, Coca-Cola. We're just not going to come in. Now, Coca-Cola can be like, right, well, we have got other customers, but Sainsbury's are pretty big. So Sainsbury's in this negotiation have got quite a lot of pull. They've got quite a lot of leverage. So Coca-Cola as the producer here and Sainsbury's as the retailer, there's actually some push and pull between those. It is not as if Coca-Cola just can say, we set the price as this, and Sainsbury's can say, okay, you're Coca-Cola. Sainsbury's can push back and say, look, last month, not enough Coke was sold. The month before that, almost nobody bought Coke. So you're going to have to either push your prices down, which means we're going to buy for less as well, because we need to make money too, Coke. And Coca-Cola can say, oh, do you know what, Sainsbury's? You can be a Pepsi store from now on. Or they can say, actually, yeah, you've got a point. We're going to reduce the price. So these sorts of negotiations that actually happen is the market actually in action. Now, post-Keynesians like Steve Keen and various others, they want to say, well, because Coca-Cola is selling in such bulk, its prices are relatively pretty stable, and therefore Coke gets to be a price setter. Okay, and Sainsbury's is a price taker, and ultimately the consumer is a price taker because the price is being set in a top-down manner. That is not actually fully true, though, because, as I said, if there was a big shift in consumer tastes, if people just stopped buying Coke, if the price strategy of Sainsbury's was wrong, or if the price strategy of Coca-Cola in the first place was wrong, or if Sainsbury's felt they weren't making enough money for it, Coca-Cola would be on the hook for losing a very, very major contract. Now, I don't know exactly how much the Sainsbury's Coke contract is, but you can bet your bottom dollar that it's a big one. And a multi-million, multi-billion pound deal in this country. In America, the numbers are going to be even bigger. Okay, so Coke is not going to want to lose that contract, or give that space to Pepsi or any of its other competitors, or allow Sainsbury's just to be like, we're not going to sell Coke anymore. We're going to push our own cola. That would be a disaster for Coke. So they need to be competitive. They need to keep, being receptive to their large clients like Sainsbury's. So therefore, the business-to-business wholesale price is not actually fixed, even though it can look quite stable for long periods of time. And a very mature product like Coca-Cola can be relatively stable. okay, and it has some elasticity in there, just like this coffee has got, you know, let's say I used to pay £4 for this. I've now stretched to £7 because I still like it as much as that. Coca-Cola has got some, people do like Coke, right? So it's got some elasticity, but it's not infinite. There is a price at which people will no longer pay for Coca-Cola in Sainsbury's. Okay, so they have to work within those parameters. So ultimately, it's being set by the consumer at the end of the line. Karl Menger and the Austrian School are still ultimately right on this. Another thing to think about is that the RRP, that is the recommended retail price, is simply the producer's hope. When Sainsbury's say, this can of Coca-Cola is £1.30, they are hoping that you as the punter will say, okay, then fair enough, I'll pay for the convenience of I'm thirsty, you know, I kind of like Coke, for the convenience of it, I'm going to buy this can for £1.30, fair enough. But let's just pretend they put that can of Coke up to £5. You know, I know, everybody else knows, nobody would buy the can of Coke at £5. Okay, now, yes, in some places like a theatre, for example, or I don't know, a remote petrol station or a theme park, right, where people are captive, where people have no alternatives. Okay, what's actually happened is that all the alternatives have been removed in those scenarios. If you're at some expensive hotel, those sorts of venues will chance their arm. They'll be like, actually, we're going to charge you £3.50 for the glass of Coke. Actually, we're glass of Coke, £4. And they, you know, they push their luck. Because in those scenarios, the parameters are changed. The value ranking is changed because you have a captive audience. There are no alternatives. Okay. But it is still just a hope. It is still just a hope of the producer or the retailer that somebody will buy it at that price. They may not. The minimum price for the good, of course, is zero. It just stays sitting there on the shelves. And we're going to get into that scenario in a second. Because if people will cast their minds back a while, there was Beyond Meat. Now, this was pushed heavily. It was pushed top down. It was launched at premium retail prices in major UK supermarkets, Sainsbury's included, and in the US as well. It was backed by intense promotional spend, huge propaganda campaign. But consumers just didn't care. They left Beyond Meat sitting on the shelves. It had unsold stock. I remember seeing it myself. Everything else was sold out. Nobody was buying the Beyond Meat whatsoever. The stock was marked down. It was sold off for, you know, pittance. So let's say it was retailing at £3. Eventually, they had to put it down to like 10p just to get somebody to buy it. It was stuck into food bank donations, into waste handling, and all of these things destroyed any anticipated margin of the Beyond Meat product. It did not make a profit. This then led to inventory write-downs. Balance sheet provisions signaled that historical production costs were irrelevant. They were only realized. Only the market prices mattered. So how much it cost to make the Beyond Meat, how much it cost to market it, how all of that stuff didn't mean a whole hill of beans to the consumers at the end of the line. All they were thinking about is, do I want this fake burger? Do I want this, you know, manufactured plant-based sausage? And the answer to that overwhelmingly was no. Therefore, there was a stock price collapse of Beyond Meat. The firm's equity lost over 90% of its peak value. The costs of the Beyond Meat did not save the price. It did not save the firm. And it was one of the most catastrophic retailing decisions in recent history. And it showed that, the supermarkets can believe they've got top-down power. Producers can believe they've got top-down power. But ultimately, at the end of the line, it's Muggins by here buying a £7 coffee who decides, do you know what? I'm not going to buy that plant-based burger. Me and millions of other people said, no way, we're not buying that. And so it was Beyond Meat was waved goodbye. So what is the Austrian explanation then for rising costs? Well, consumer demand rises elsewhere. Alternative input uses become valuable. Producers bid more for their inputs. Input prices rise. Output prices reflect increased opportunity costs. These are all things that can make costs rise, according to the Austrians. Another thing I want to touch on before we get out of here is predictable and mature markets. Now, this is something I've talked about before. Coca-Cola actually is a very mature market, as is in this country, washing up liquid. If you have a look, I have a subscription to this site called Statistica. If you pull up a market like UK washing up liquids, you will see year on year, decade on decade, going back all the way back to the 60s and 70s at this point, Fairy Liquid is consistently the number one selling washing up liquid in this country. And its total sales are something like 20, 21 million, okay, people buy Fairy Liquid, okay, every week or something like that. And the charts, year on year, decade on decade, look almost identical. Okay, they may go up marginally as the population of Britain increases, or they may go up and down as the population fluctuates. But basically, it's a very predictable market, as is Coca-Cola. And the structure of each market also is quite predictable. So in the beverages market, Coca-Cola is a pretty firm market leader. It's about 70%. In the washing up market, it's Fairy Liquid, about 70%. Then the runner-up gets about 30% of the market. In the case of Coca-Cola, that is, of course, Pepsi Cola. That is the number two brand. And then behind that, it's all your supermarket own, you know, cheapy colas, or your Sainsbury's own, you know, Asda's own, etc. Basically, every market looks like that. In the washing up liquid market, you know, let's say it's Fairy Liquid number one. You'd have to look what the number two is. Right, it's probably one of those other brands like Persil or something. I don't know if Persil make a Fairy Liquid, but you know, it's one of those other brands that would be your number two, and then it's your supermarket's own. Okay, and typically most markets are like that. You know, one brand, two brand, supermarket's own. And you know, in the past on this channel, I've said, well, how much choice are you really getting? You know, especially in these mature markets. You know, how much of this market truly is bottom up. But the fact is that these stable markets, all they're really saying is that people like buying Fairy Liquid and Coca-Cola. They are not set in stone. There is a theoretical future where people just simply stop buying, you know, these goods in such a ubiquitous way. Last week, I made a video on white eggs and brown eggs. Sainsbury's are bringing white eggs back. One of the shocking things that I mentioned in that video is that at one point, all of the people in Britain brought white eggs. And then in the 70s, that completely changed to the point where brown eggs accounted for 99% of all eggs sold in the UK. That's a very drastic change from white eggs to brown eggs. Practically overnight, that happened. So these sorts of changes can happen. Okay, they can happen suddenly. So yes, you could say, well, Fairy Liquid has had 80 years, or Coca-Cola has had over 100 years of people enjoying buying its beverages in quite large quantities. But that is not fixed in stone. That is not necessarily going to persist forever. Stability does not refute subjectivism. People are still making subjective valuations. Now, you could say that Coca-Cola or Fairy Liquid is owned by probably, is it Johnson & Johnson or Unilever? Actually, I think it's Procter & Gamble, right? You could say that Procter & Gamble or Coca-Cola or these giant corporations spend vast sums of money to try to get in here, to try to convince and manipulate people, to try to affect their subjective valuations Okay, yeah, sure, that goes on. But ultimately, for whatever reason people are saying they like these products, it is still their preferences that are being reinforced at the point of sale. Okay, this is not an objective, like at the moment it's true that people like these products, but it's not necessarily going to be true forever. Okay, and you do get massive shifts. You know, the famous one of a Blockbuster Video, VHS rental, just videos in general, DVDs being killed off by streaming. That happened. Okay, just because things have been true for a long period does not mean that they're going to be true forever. Oat milk has been a big trend. You know, more people being lactose intolerant has affected the milk market in this country, for example. Ex post predictability is perfectly compatible with forward-looking subjective judgment. The market process is never static. It merely appears so between disruptions. And who knows what it will be at some point. But at some point, Coca-Cola will have its kind of stranglehold on people wanting to drink it disrupted, as will Fairy Liquid. When that will happen, it could be another 100 years. Who knows? But at some point, it will happen. No market persists forever. Then there is the objection from Steve Keens and various other post-Keynesians. Steve Keen, his name is. He's here on YouTube as well. You should check him out. But on this, I actually disagree with him because he says, well, look, if you have a look at all of these studies, the first one was done by Hall and Hitch in 1939, where they said, we're going to go out and survey all of the managers of all of the factories, and we're going to kind of ask them, how are you setting your prices? And when all of the managers said, well, we set our price by looking at our costs and then we add a markup. And then the Keynesians, and then finally the post-Keynesians said, well, look, we've got all of this empirical evidence by literally just going and asking the firms themselves, how do you set the prices? The firms themselves are saying, we're setting our prices by saying we look at our costs and then we add our profit, we add the markup. And so how can anybody argue against this? They say, look at those Austrian fools. They are sticking with outdated theories when empirical facts have disproven them. Namely, we did a survey and asked the managers. Well, here's the problem. One, managers of firms are not immune to these psychological effects that we've been talking about. That's the first thing. Firms overall are not immune to these psychological effects. And also, it still is setting the RRP, that is the, you know, the price that the firm hopes to sell it for, the recommended retail price. It is taking that price as the price, as the gospel price. Whereas a truly empirical look at the true price of any good would just be like, well, yeah, but how many were sold on sale? How many were sold at a discount? How many were sold, by the firm trying to get rid of their stock at the end of the month? How many were sold? Okay, if it's a big bulk deal like Coca-Cola selling to Sainsbury's on a special discount deal done for one account manager by another account manager, because that is the actual price. The actual reveal preference is that price, not the one that you hope to sell it for. And this little detail goes missing because they treat the recommended retail price as the actual price. And of course, firms don't release actual. Okay, they say, oh, well, the price of a can of Coke is this. Here are our profits. But they don't tell you exactly how much that went for in every single case. So this is where I maintain the difference between real economics actual economics and people just making speculations with abstract figures. And now we may not have that figure of the actual revealed price at the end of it. We may not have it. So another possible objection is actually one that could come from readers of Ludwig von Mises, who in his classic book, Human Action, argues that the double-entry bookkeeping was one of the great intellectual achievements of market civilization, that Western civilization development of double-entry bookkeeping was a powerful instrument for entrepreneurial calculation. And if you remember, Mises was all about the calculation problem, that socialism and central planners would not be able to calculate things because they cannot calculate their input costs. Okay. Accounting records ex post results using market prices that already incorporate subjective valuations. It is a language built on the outcome of subjective exchange, not an independent measure of objective economic cost. Okay, so Mises's point is that double entry bookkeeping made it easier for entrepreneurs to forecast. They made it easier to calculate their input costs and therefore to try to make more money at the end of it. Okay, their input costs are what they are, and then what the amount of money they're trying to make after it. Okay, but let's not forget that even those input costs that they're calculating in the double entry bookkeeping are psychological. Okay, yes, you could say, well, the amount of money that he has in his bank is objective, and that he did pay £10 for this and he made 20 pounds in revenue on selling the good, therefore he's made £10. Okay, but really, that the only person that matters to is the firm. Doesn't really matter to anybody else. Still in the, only in that guy's head. Let's say he failed to do it and made a loss instead, right? I mean, okay, ultimately he's going to go out of business, something like this. But hopefully you understand the subtlety of this point that I've been laboring to make over the past hour. What accounts capture? Historical transaction prices, depreciation schedules, realized margins, useful summaries of past decisions and their monetary outcomes. But what accounts miss is forward-looking subjective opportunity costs that actually governed those decisions, the value of roads not taken, the options not exercised, alternatives genuinely sacrificed. So remember, this is the Philip Wicksteed point and also James Buchanan point. The account ledger still only is money costs, right? It's not factoring in all those other things, okay? I decided to sell marbles this month and I paid so much money for the marbles and I hope to sell them at this, you know, increased price. And then we, you know, we take away what I paid for them from what I sold them for, and then I made a profit or a loss. Okay, fair enough. But what about all the yo-yos I didn't buy? What about all the Tazoos and, you know, all of the other gimmick items that I could have bought instead? Maybe it's not marbles that are in, but yo-yos. So the opportunity cost, really, the real cost was foregoing all those other things. And, you know, to really see that, you couldn't see it on the account books. You'd have to look at the thing. You'd have to kind of analyze the whole market, you know, the children's entertainment toy, minor toy market, whatever marbles come in, to see, oh, well, actually, it's yo-yos that are the hot thing. Maybe I should have invested in those instead. I made a poor call, something like that, okay? Another thing that Buchanan picked up on is that accounting provides a language for discussing business performance. It does not provide objective economic truth about costs in the choice theoretic sense. The two must not be confused. Accountants measure what happened. Economists, properly understood, analyze what was foregone. So he's like, do not forget about the opportunity that we were talking about here, because the accountant's ledger cannot tell the full story. It can probably tell the business owner, okay, help him keep a track of how much money he spent and how much money he's got coming in, okay? But it also doesn't change the fact that this is still psychological and does not actually affect the prices at the end. It's just a hope. I hope to make money. I spent this amount, but I hope to recoup some of it back. But I'm just making another, I'm not even recouping it. I'm making another £7. Not the same seven, but that £7 is gone. It's gone to the shop I bought this in. Didn't even go to Nescafe, by the way, because the money spent by the shop on the wholesale purchase of this jar is already foregone. So I helped the shop out. Nescafe have already got their money. They were laughing already. So anyway, let's carry on. What are the policy implications? Okay, so first of all, we have the knowledge problem. This is F.A. Hayek's wheelhouse, really. If cost is irreducibly subjective, dispersed, and personal, outsiders, including governments and planners, cannot know it. So for central planners, this is a problem because they cannot replicate the subjective cost calculations of millions of individual choosers. Hayek's knowledge problem is at root a cost knowledge problem. Also, in cost-benefit analysis, official CBA assigns monetary figures to subjective foregone alternatives, an empirically impossible task disguised in precise arithmetic. Okay? We do not know the full impact of all of those choices not taken, all of those opportunity costs that you paid. You don't know. I paid opportunity costs making this video. I could have talked about the news. I could have talked about any number of things. I could have talked about Shakespeare. Today, I decided to talk about economics because I thought this was an important topic to get in. And I can't know all of those choices that have been foregone. I can't know how the theoretical other video I could have made would have gone, how many views it would have got. You could say, well, you could try to make that a different day. But the fact is, on any particular day, the algos are slightly different. You know, topics are hot for 1 minute and then they're not hot for another minute. Okay, so every time I make a video, I forego all of those other possible videos I could have made. Okay, and every time you watch a video, you forego all those other things that you could have been doing. Okay, but so it is with everything. And this is impossible to calculate. Very, very difficult to calculate. Then there are price controls. Fixing prices severs the signal that communicates objective valuation across the economy, destroying the very information needed for coordination. Now, let's pretend that Keir Starmer here in this country, who fancies himself as a bit of a Marxist, decides enough is enough, Nescafe. All of these coffee producers need to stop being so greedy, or they will face the full force of the law. I decree that coffee shall now only be £6 and no more. Otherwise, you shall face the full force of the law. Well, let's pretend the price point is at £7 because of the aforementioned environmental problems they are experiencing in Brazil. I think they had a drought in 2025. Yields were down across the board in coffee. Therefore, coffee prices shot up. Okay. I remember this same jar being closer to £4 or £5 just a year or so ago. It's gone up to £7 now. Okay. Now, Keir Starmer can set that price as much as he wants. He can set it at £6 or £5 or £4. It's not actually going to affect the total amount of coffee at the end of the line. What would happen if he set the price, let's say, at £3? The coffee would sell out everywhere and there'd just be a shortage on the shelves. It would be a case of who could get to the coffee quickest, which is why a lot of socialist countries historically have experienced empty shelves, massive queues, and so on. It is because you are severing the price signal Okay, and this happens whenever people try to fix prices. You end up with shortages. Doesn't just happen in the food market. It happens in any market, including in the housing market, where you know they talk about rent controls. I mean, it's one of the most consistently observed phenomenon in the history of economics, that if you try to fix the price of rent, it leads to housing shortage and massive waiting lists, because you are not actually affecting the underlying economic fact, which is the supply and the demand. You are simply messing with the signal that is set by price, and you're offsetting. And so now it has to be some other mechanism queuing up, whoever gets there first, whoever knows the right person, right? I've got an in with Diane Abbott. That means I can get, you know, good social housing in Hackney, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So these things do have policy implications as well. I hope you've enjoyed this video. A bit of a return to Austrian economics for me, but I've been meaning to make this one for a while. Yeah, it's something that I'd be interested to know what people think, especially those who do not come from the Austrian school. I think that this is a way of thinking about costs that cannot really be countered, because it is actually describing what happens. And it's being a little bit pedantic about describing what happens, but it is what happens. And if you take those shortcuts like Alfred Marshall did, or like the Keynesians do, and so on, you forget about it at some part of the line, and then you fall into error. And then that can have longer term, much more wide reaching and even devastating consequences. You can go back and watch my videos on the economic policies that ruined dot, 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 and then various different countries, and just see how many of them were, famines were induced by governments introducing price controls on food. That's always how it starts. Okay. Always going to be topical. There's always somebody trying to fix prices somewhere. Sadiq Khan in London is trying to do it. That dude in New York is trying to do it. And because I'm committed to the truth, I will always tell you the truth. And that's why I don't ever fully abandon Austrian economics, despite not being a libertarian anymore. Hope you enjoyed this. If you enjoyed this video, you could pick up one of my courses at the Academic Agency. Buy it now. I've recently made the Ultra Bundle available, and I'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.